Technology is a two-edged sword, and it's also got a couple of razor blades hidden in the handle. I've been looking up a bit of stuff about movies, as I always do for the podcast, and one of the things I found out is that modern movies, particularly the big ones, have a very limited colour palette. The reason I'm saying this is, I watched an old movie yesterday, in fact, it was Arabian Nights, starring John Hall and Maria Montez and Sabu. It was a very early Technicolor film from 1942. And one of the things I noticed about it that really kind of jabbed me in the retinas was how brilliant the Technicolor is, how eye-poppingly, fantastically bright and colourful this pretty much run-of-the-mill Arabian Nights movie from the 1940s was compared to the way we see film in 2010. And I also serendipitously saw a blog article about how colour palettes have diminished in film. Apparently there's a visual tweak that you can do on a whole film all at one go while you're making a movie. What it does is it emphasises the orange colours and the teal colours, the ones that are kind of in the greeny part of the spectrum, so that human faces kind of are emphasised above all else in the film. It's a recent technology that only came in the last 10 years. I think the first time it was used was for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Coen Brothers movie. But every movie is doing it now. I'll post a link to this blog article on the website because it's really fascinating how diminished the colour spectrum of modern cinema is. And of course, one can say there are parallels between that and the diminution of the ability to script and not make every film a remake. But I found it very interesting that these early Technicolor films are so eye-poppingly brilliant compared to modern films. Even a film like Avatar with its kind of greeny blue palette, even when it wasn't outdoors on the planet Pandora. Very limited colour palette, and I think we've lost something there. I think that there's an argument for the possibility that movies be brilliant, they be heightened. Some films still do it. I'm not kind of tarring everybody with the same brush. But I really think that a really eye-poppingly brilliant film with kind of old-school Technicolor values. I mean, I'd like to see a science fiction film with that kind of thing. Some eye-poppingly brilliant future with no kind of grey-green overtones to it. Just a fantastic, vivid, or a vividly imagined world. Anyway, that's just a little bit of a rant for the start of the podcast. My name's Terry Frost, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 50. That's the new theme song. It's called Strings of Fire. I found it and I thought the old one's getting a little bit stale, and it's the 50th podcast. I'm going to be changing a few things. So I would also change the theme tune. So I wanted something with lots of syrupy strings and bongos in the background, all that kind of stuff. And I found that, and that's what we're running with. So let me know what you think. Before I get into everything, I'm going to get Sal to do the intro. The intro's changed a little bit. You might hear a little bit different from it. But after that, I'll talk about the changes that have been made to Paleo Cinema, what I've been watching lately. We'll have a few voicemails from people offering congratulations, love, sex, and lots of money. Actually, just the first one. And get into it and talk about the three movies I'm going to talk about this time around.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at cinema between 1895 and 1990. We look at cult films, science fiction, action movies, foreign language cinema, and anything else that might be interesting. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The podcast website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast may contain adult words and content, so if your kids listen to it, you may have to explain a lot of uncomfortable things to them.
Okay, as you might have figured out from Sal's intro, I've expanded Paleo Cinema up to 1990 from up to 1980. I did think about it for a while. There are some movies in the 80s that I really wanted to cover in Paleo Cinema, and I didn't want to have to excuse it every time that I did it. So I put a little bit of a tweet out to people saying, what do you think if I expand it to 1990? And that filtered through to my Facebook as well. And the response was overwhelmingly positive. People said, go for it. Just do what you like. We love hearing it. So that's what we're doing. I've expanded it up to 1990. I'm not going to take it any further than that for the foreseeable future. I think a lot of people are covering movies more recent than that. And I want to kind of keep that special cachet that Paleo Cinema has by looking at older films. So I've got 20 years in the past, basically, to play with there, everything before 20 years in the past, which is, I think, enough to keep me busy for a very, very long time. So how are things going over here on the arse end of the world? It's doing fine. I've done 2 weeks of training in my new job, and all of that's going really nicely. I'm learning a shitload of stuff about mobile phone networks and all sorts of other things that I'm going to have to deal with in my new position. And the people I'm working with are very nice, very professional, and everything is going very smoothly at this stage, so I'm very happy about that. Of course, this means that I don't have as much time to watch movies as I used to when I wasn't working, but I have managed to catch up with a number of films anyway, so I'll talk about those in just a moment. Anything else interesting happening? Yeah, apparently it's Easter. It's got something to do with crucified chocolate bunnies or something like that. A lot of people, there's a big discussion at the moment about, I don't know how it is elsewhere in the world, but in Australia there's been a lot of atheist bashing by members of all of the major religions, pretty much, except Judaism, so thank you, Jews. They've been pretty much saying that atheism's a religion and doing all that kind of stuff, which makes it very interesting for me because it's something I'm interested in. I'm not going to gabble on too much about that. But I did read something interesting in that regard when people say that atheism is a religion. Somebody said that atheism is a religion just like baldness is a hair colour. So I'll leave you with that thought and I won't go too much else about that. I found the discussions very interesting and the debate about it very interesting, and I think it's going in some fun directions. Anything else happening around here? Robert Culp died. That's what I should mention. Robert Culp. I mentioned him in my very first Paleo Cinema when I reviewed the season one box set of Ice by the TV series he did in the 1960s with Bill Cosby. I liked Robert Culp a lot. Very fine actor. I think he could do comedy, he could also do drama. Anyone who saw Walter Hill's Hickey and Boggs can verify that. A lot of people know him from things like The Greatest American Hero and his later work and an Eminem music video he did once upon a time. But if you go out on Google Books and look up a little bit, you'll see that he also did some film writing, which is a bit more pertinent to what I'm doing here. He's written a lot about Sam Peckinpah, and because he did work with him in TV westerns in the late 50s and very early 1960s. So he's got a bit to say about Peckinpah. He's got a bunch to say about other things, and he brings an actor's viewpoint to what he says about that, which makes it interesting, the same way that Richard E. Grant's books are interesting because they come at the movies that he's making from an actor's viewpoint, and they show the insecurities of actors and what they do when they're not filming and they're out on location, all sorts of interesting things like that. So I also read Richard E. Grant's book, With Nails, which is a bit of a filmmaker's diary that he's put out. Recommend that one as well. And the other thing I've really been doing is I read Robert Wagner's autobiography, and I recommend that. I think it's something like Things from the Heart, or I think it's called. And it's very interesting. It gives you a lot of back Hollywood gossip. And it shows you a man who's gone through a lot of shit in his life. Of course, his wife, Natalie Wood, died on a boat in Catalina. Recommend that one. If you can get a copy from a library or pick up a copy, it's a pretty good read. There's a lot of movie back office stuff, which I found very interesting. And the style of the writing, and I don't know whether that's a ghostwriter or Wagner himself, it's a bit funny where autobiographies are concerned, whose prose style is shown in that. But I do recommend it. Good read. And a lot of fun there. I picked that up from the local library while I was off and kind of devoured it in half a day. The other thing is I've upgraded the system that I work on to Windows 7. I was going to look at going totally Ubuntu Linux or something like that, but just couldn't be fucked doing it, really. So I upgraded to that, and the miraculous thing that happened when I upgraded was that I could now effectively use my Blue Snowball microphone, my great big baseball-sized Blue Snowball, and that's what I'm recording on at the moment. I don't have this great big phallic thing like my other mic sticking in my face. I've got a nice rounded tit-like microphone to record the podcast with. Okay, what I've been watching, I've got my list out now so I can talk about that. I did see on the recommendation of the GGTMC mob, Samurai and Big William, From Paris with Love, the Paris set action film starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and John Travolta, camping it up outrageously. Yeah, it was a pretty good action film. Nothing pretentious. A lot of fun, a lot of funny dialogue, a lot of shooting bad people, a lot of throwing around vases full of cocaine, and all the other things that one wants in an action film. And pretty much any film that's set in the streets of Paris I'll watch, because I like Paris, as you know. And, yeah, it's nothing big. It's about the right length for a meathead action film. And it does what's on the label. So I saw that. I did watch Ninja Assassin as well. I'm less in love with Ninja Assassin. The CGI blood and the kung fu action sequences are okay. But I really think it took itself way too seriously. There was no fun in it. If you're going to do an outrageous, splattery ninja assassin type film, you really do need to lighten the fuck up a little bit, and this one just was totally out of lightening the fuck up. So I saw that. Cinecoltania recommended a movie for me, Dying Breed, which happened to be on cable here. It's a movie about a whole small town of Tasmanian cannibals, and very Wolf Creek-y in a lot of ways. Can't say I really enjoyed the film, because it's not the sort of film you enjoy, it's the sort of film you endure. And I'm glad I saw it, and it's another way for me to argue against going on a holiday to Tasmania when Sal brings up the subject, because he likes going to Tasmania. It's not all cannibals and rape, apparently. So she wants to go there anyway, so I suppose we will at some stage end up going down to the little female pubic patch beneath Australia. Let's see what else. I watched a couple of Mr. Moto films starring Peter Lorre. They're both from 1937. One of them was Think Fast, Mr. Moto, and the other one was Thank You, Mr. Moto. They're quite fun. Peter Lorre playing a Japanese detective who's very good at judo, and they have that kind of fake Hollywood Asian locations in them. Character actors wall to wall. Some talking roles for Asian actors, which wasn't that common in Hollywood at the time. But, of course, the main Asian character is played by Peter Lorre. But in spite of that, I think it works well. They've got intelligent characters of other races in it. And in spite of the fact that there is that issue of the main character being played by a Caucasian, they do hold up quite well, and they're a little bit of a fun. Very much studio-bound. There's not too much location shooting. But, you know, a little bit of a mystery, a little bit of fun, and a look back into the cinema of the past. So I did enjoy those as well. What else did I watch? I saw Night at the Museum 2, which is kind of more of the same in a way. It's a CGI fest. Ben Stiller wears thin very quickly, I find, in movies, unless he's getting his dick caught in the zipper and giving Cameron Diaz hair gel. What I did like was, and this is a movie buff thing totally, Hank Azaria playing an ancient Egyptian king who's brought back to life by the magic gubbins in the museum, playing it very much like Boris Karloff. Now, I suppose he can get away with it because a lot of younger movie viewers, and this is very much skewed to the younger demographic, you know, prepubescent and upwards, can get away. It can get away with playing a Boris Karloff voiced character as a kind of knowing wink to the people who know the stuff, and it looks a bit creepy to other people. But I found that quite a bit of fun. He did go a bit over the top with it, but Hank Azaria and Amy Adams pretty much saved the film. I found Amy Adams mostly because she was cute and she was wearing very tight jodhpurs. But that and the bit where they go through the art gallery and all of the works of art are coming to life, I kind of like that little conceit, but that's more a technician thing than the actor's thing. So the background's in a lot of cases more interesting than some of the actors. Robin Williams doing Teddy Roosevelt again. The other thing is, can somebody please explain to me what the fuck is the attraction of Ricky Gervais? I just find him insufferable. He's a kind of soccer ball-headed doofus. He plays the same kind of shtick character in everything he does. And it's not a particularly interesting character. I mean, back in the Ealing film days, English actors could get away with that, playing one kind of role because they were very much secondary characters. But yeah, I never warmed to Ricky Gervais. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that disagree with me, and that's okay. But really, the guy didn't grab me that much. That's about all I really want to talk about. I just come to the end of the list that I made. I didn't write down every movie that I saw. But what I'm going to do first is go into one of the voicemails saying congratulations about the podcast. This one is from Vince over at B Movie Cast. So I'll just play that and then I'll get stuck into the movie 17 minutes into the podcast.
B Movie Cast, calling in to wish you a happy 50th show. That's great that you got to 50, and I want to see about, 250 more. I've been listening to the show, really been enjoying it. You turned me on to a lot of movies that I haven't seen or I've been, wanting to see since maybe I might have saw them a long time ago. But anyway, I just wish I had more time to see them. I can hardly watch the movies I can see now. But last show you did on Fuller, you were one of his movies, I guess, is The Big Red One, starring Lee Marvin. And he is one of my favorite actors. I wish you might be able to do some stuff on Lee Marvin sometime or Ernest Borgnine. I like his movies. Point Blank would be a good one. Prime Cut or Emperor of the North has him and Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine in it, so that might be a cool movie to do. Also, on one of your shows, you mentioned about that we ought to do the H-Man. Well, we did it, a few shows back. I can't remember the number, so you might want to check it out. But anyway, I'm going to stop talking now, and happy 50th show, and hello to all the listeners, and just keep the great podcast commentary. Later, Terry. Ciao.
Thanks for that, Vince. Vince has been a big supporter of the podcast right from the early days. He showed me a few tricks on the website and a few other things early on, how to put up an iTunes link and things like that. And he has been incredibly supportive, so thank you for that. There's a certain fellowship to podcasters. I've spoken about this before, but just the closeness that people get across vast distances and the encouragement that everybody who podcasts gets if they reach out to other podcasters is just one of the better things about doing this. Having an audience is good too, but assistance and just the TLC you get from other podcasters is quite an experience. So basically I'm going to let you know now which three movies I'm talking about. Some of you may know already if you snuck in and looked at the Facebook page or the Twitter stream. I'm doing two movies from 1988/1989. First one being the classic action film of the late 80s, Die Hard, starring Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman. I'm also doing an Asian film. I haven't done one for a while, so I thought it was about time. I'm doing Dosan, also known as God of Gamblers, starring the best and coolest Asian film star of all time, Chow Yun-fat. And lastly, I'm doing the first of the Merchant Ivory films, The Wild Party from 1975, starring James Coco, Raquel Welch, David Dukes, and a bunch of other people. So I'm just going to toss a dice now, have a little bit of a music sting, and then get stuck into the first movie, whichever one flips on the three-sided dice.
It was a typical Hollywood party, I guess, except for the way it ended. Yes, I saw it all. I knew them all and why they'd come. For easy pickings and bootleg rum, for power or just the smell of it, for money or just the hell of it. Everybody was on the make for a piece of someone, someone's take. They were there for kicks, for bucks, or laughter. But Queenie, what was Queenie after? Queenie was the mistress of Jolly Grimm, funny man of the films. But you recognize him. A big man in movies. Hollywood elite. Born Carlo Grimaldi on Delancey Street. Queenie was a doll whose age stood still. She used to dance in vaudeville. Dark eyes, lips like glowing coals. The kind for whom men sell their souls. Late Saturday morning, broiling hot. Queenie woke up feeling shot. Maybe she woke from a dream with a cast of the four flushing hustlers who loved her last. Used her. Abused her in her checkered past. So, now you know. A fascinating woman as they go. Charlie was up, ugly and threatening. Hardly the lovable comedy king. Years ago, he'd have showered and shaved first thing. But now, since they said he'd lost his touch, how he looked in private didn't matter much. He was depressed, obsessed with the thought of the comeback he needed to make, and the thought of failure, and what was at stake if he lost, which was a lot more than the money it cost. A Hollywood trade paper spread before him listed the grosses of Chaplin's picks, and Harold Lloyd's, and Keaton's clicks. The whole paper seemed to ignore him.
Okay, The Wild Party is a 1975 Merchant Ivory film. Ismail Merchant and James Ivory produced it. James Ivory directed it. One of the other producers for the film was Samuel Z. Arkoff. The film was actually released by American International, the same company that did all those Vincent Price, Roger Corman films and beach party movies and things like that about a decade before. They actually produced the first Merchant Ivory film, and Merchant Ivory we know from films like Remains of the Day and all of those kind of classy British films based on classical novels and things like that. They started out working with a schlock master like Samuel Arkoff, which I found quite interesting. The film doesn't have a tremendously large budget, and there are some problems with some of the actors involved. And I'll just give you, the audio clip I played for you gave you the précis of the film pretty much. Jolly Grimm, played by James Coco, is a kind of comedy actor in the silent era. He's trying to make a comeback after 5 years, and so he's made a film called Brother Jasper, which is a kind of half-comedy, half-pious film about a historic Franciscan priest in California in the previous century, and it's a kind of misguided attempt at credibility for Jolly Grimm. The silence have ended. It's 1929, so the silent film era has ended. He's made a silent film, and a lot of the jokes and the shtick in the silent film are, even at that stage, unsophisticated and hackneyed and cliched. But he doesn't realise it. He's kind of... this is his one chance to regain his career, and he really doesn't want to let go of it. And the Jimmy, the David Dukes character, the guy who narrates the poem, advises him of the mistakes that are in the film and the things that need to be managed, and he totally dismisses that. He's a passive-aggressive character. He drinks too much. He's really on the way down. So, source material. This is kind of a mashup, this film. Before there were mashups, the first source material is a 1928, I think it is, prose poem by Joseph Moncure March. If that name sounds familiar, it's because I've done another movie in paleo cinema based on a poem by Joseph Moncure March. In the ninth paleo cinema podcast, I talked about a film called The Setup with Robert Ryan and Audrey Totter in it. It was actually based on a poem about a Negro boxer, as it was then, a poem that March wrote about a boxer and the end of his career. So this is based on a source material by the same author who wrote for The New Yorker and amongst other things. The edition of the poem I've got is the really cool one from, when was it? I'll just get my little book out here. It was from 1994. It's there was a modified version of the poem released in the 1940s, which took out some anti-Semitic verses. And this version from 1994 goes back to the original text and is also has a lot of drawings by Art Spiegelman, who you might remember did the cartoon comic book Mouse, which was about a bunch of mice in concentration camps. Very well respected artist. And he's done some great drawings around the poem. So if you want to find a copy of this one, there are a few on eBay, and they're not too expensive. So, you might want to pick that up. Very interesting poem. And the poem, as read by Jimmy the David Duke's character in the movie, uses a few of the verses, but it uses the same verse style as March's original poem and adapts it to the source material. The other source material for the film is the Fatty Arbuckle scandal from 1921, where Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, very famous comic, had a scandal because he had a kind of wild party in a hotel room in San Francisco, and a girl called Virginia Rapp was there and went off into the back room to canoodle with Arbuckle, and died a few days later of various kind of hemorrhages from her, what some people call girl parts. Arbuckle was acquitted on three different trials for this one, but his career was pretty much over after that, and he died in 1933. So they kind of took the concept of a rotund comedian's downfall and ran with that as a part of the story for the Wild Party. They adapted it. Now, the original source material isn't about Hollywood at all. It's about a couple of vaudeville performers, a dancer called Queenie and a vaudeville clown called Burr, who's her boyfriend, and they have a party in their rather shoddy apartment in New York, and a lot of the characters are paralleled in the movie, but the whole milieu of it is somewhat different, but this kind of sleazy ugliness is retained, but in a kind of Merchant Ivory way. But we'll say this, of all the Merchant Ivory films I've seen, this one has the best orgy scenes. Remains of the Day could not touch it as far as orgy scenes are concerned. So basically, it's in that kind of 20s jazz age. Bootleggers, the change from silence to sound, fruit stands in orange groves in the San Fernando Valley, and uneducated migrants and the children of migrants making it big in Hollywood. So Jolly Grimm, being Carlo Grimaldi from Delancey Street, is very much a self-educated man, but one who doesn't trust advice. And you know, he's okay when he's not drunk, but when he's drunk, he gets extremely nasty. And that's shown in a couple of different scenes in the film. James Coco acting, and he was mostly a comedian and was most famously known probably for being Sancho Panza in the film version of Man of La Mancha. In the reviews of this film on IMDb, there's a lot of discussion on whether James Coco is over the top or not, playing Jolly Grimm and the arc of the character. I think he's kind of at the top end of his talent doing this, in a sense. There are bits which work very well. There are bits which don't work quite as well. But, he gives it a go and essays the character acceptably. The big problem I have with the film is Raquel Welch's Queenie. I don't think her talents or her ability to step outside of her own persona was sufficient for her to really do the character justice. And the character is complex. And the dialogue given to the character is complex, but I don't think that Raquel Welch particularly puts it across extremely well. There are a number of songs in the film which were written for the film by the screenwriter Walter Marx. I've got to be careful there because there's Joseph Moncure March and there's Walter Marx. So I've got a couple of similar names to juggle in this one. The secondary characters, the actors playing them are the most interesting ones, and in a sense steal the film from it. David Jukes is very good as Jimmy, who is assisting Jolly with the creation of the film and the writing of the Brother Jasper film. And he also has a crush on Queenie, which pretty much everybody does. And also Tiffany Bolling playing one of Queenie's girlfriends, who brings along the man who Queenie ends up being attracted to during the course of the party, an up-and-coming Errol Flynn or Valentino type actor called Dale Sword, played by Perry King when he was very young and good-looking and things like that. You might remember he was the President of the United States in The Day After Tomorrow in much later days. But he's pretty good in this. He does what needs to be done to portray a good-looking character. And the secondary character, particularly Tiffany Bolling, is extremely good in this film. She brings Dale along. Dale ends up shacking up with Queenie. And her character's arc, going from "I've got the best-looking man in Hollywood on my arm" to "She's stolen my guy," is very good. She does get to sing a song as well, and it is her voice in the film. She was known to be a very good singer as well as an actress. Didn't do a lot of work, but did enough quality work that it's a bit of a shame she didn't go on to do more things. I think Hollywood has this ability at times to underestimate its female talent, particularly if they haven't had a starring role. These days it's a little bit easier because she's the sort of actor who would do fantastically well in, say, an HBO TV series and be brought to the attention of the public and of the powers that be through that means. But that wasn't really the case in the 70s when she was active as an actress. And it's a bit of a shame because she kind of, in some way, she's the kind of heart of the film in various different scenes. Now, there are the usual crew of jazz age hangers-on in the film. There's a pair of gay brothers who play the piano and sing and who are very much into each other, if you know what I mean. There's a slightly predatory and vampish lesbian character. And, well, what I'll do is I'll play another little bit of audio from it just to give you Jimmy, the character's view on the people who come to this wild party.
Christ, what a crew. Take a look at Madeline True. People flocked to the film she made, loving the cutie pie part she played. She was every man's sweetheart, every woman's guide. Venus and Adonis, which she never tried to hide. Men dreamed of a real-life wife like this adorable thespian. Or fools they. The typical pair of minor movie producers stood engrossed, bewailing high production cost. Each of them had suffered most. In 20 minutes, each had lost the sum of $60 million, with gestures, after which they sighed and drank, panting, tragic-eyed, mopping at sadly wilted collars. Then Jackie, perfect of form and face. In his veins flowed the blood of more than one race. He left a subtle trail of scent floating behind him as he went. An Apache dancer with a special act. New York or Paris, his house was packed. He brought marijuana for all to puff. And later, he'd bring out the stronger stuff. Cocaine, morphine, Turkish hash. Everything for a proper bash. Poor Bertha. Now Jackie's ex-partner in dance. He tossed her around on his last tour of France till she fractured a leg. Now she walks with a limp. But she still works for Jack. She's his whore. He's her pimp.
Okay, so you can pretty much guess that it all ends in tears and disaster and horror and nastiness and ugliness and all sorts of other bits and pieces there. One of the other character actors I should mention in this film is Royal Dano. He appeared in a whole bunch of westerns and things, and he plays kind of Jolly Grimm's bodyguard come assistant, and he has some of the best lines in the movie. And he's another person who's really the heart of the film. Technically, the main character should be the heart of a film, but I think the main characters in this film don't really step up to the plate enough to be that. And it's the minor characters, it's the ambience of the film, it's the story arc, it's Jimmy's narration as he writes the poem about the events of the party, and all of that that really makes this film. It's got a beautiful period feel to it too. The dialogue and the slang used and the way people think and speak is very much of the time, which is, of course, is a Merchant Ivory trait. The people are very much of their time in Merchant Ivory period films, and this goes right back to the Wild Party. Very good in that. Set design's fantastic. Dresses, costumes. The music, as I said, by Walter Marx is terrific. He didn't do much else in the cinema, but he's, along with the narration by Jimmy, the songs that he creates for this film help carry the narrative very well. And I like it. I saw this film first in the cinemas way back in the dim darks when I was trying to see more grown-up cinema, as I was quite youngish at the time. Oh, I think I might have been about 18 when it came out, something like that. I wanted to see more grown-up films, but I didn't want to see films that would be boring, and I didn't find this film boring at the time. I found it very decadent and interesting, and there was just enough nudity to keep an 18-year-old boy happy. But it was only years later that I found out it was a Merchant Ivory film, and I thought, what the fuck? You know, what's going on here? And I wish they had have done more sleazy films with odd source material. But the parallels between this film and the Fatty Arbuckle thing are only very rudimentary. You know, like the fall of a fat silent movie comedian pretty much covers it in a slightly sexual scandal. But the upshot is very different. So you might want to check this out. As I said, it's not the best film, and I think it does have some flaws to it. But I found it interesting, and I always look kind of like movies that have odd source material. They always tend to not be quite as mainstream as we'd think they'd be. So that's it, The Wild Party, 1975. I believe it is available on DVD through the usual outlets and also through the other more subterranean sources, if you know what I mean. So I'm going to take another break, and then I'm going to look at the second of the three films, being God of Gamblers, starring Chow Yun-fat.
Congratulations on yet another fantastic episode, Terry. And what an episode. The Big 5-0. Happy birthday, Paleo Cinema. It's Ben from Cinecultania Podcast here. You can find us at cinecultania.blogspot.com. Alex, unfortunately, couldn't join us today. She's very, very busy at the moment, but she sends her kindest regards and all the best for another 50. Just have to say, loved the Sam Fuller episode. I saw Shock Corridor one Christmas day many, many years ago, and I've been meaning to watch it ever again, even because it's just a film you can't just watch once. I'm a big fan of The Baron of Arizona. I would love to hear you cover that at some point. I know there's that Criterion put out that box set of three early Sam Fullers with that, and The Steel Helmet, and I think one of his westerns. Perhaps Paleo Cinema could cover that box set at some point. That would be fantastic. I'm a big Vincent Price fan. He's my number one favourite actor of all time, so him and Sam Fuller together, wonderful. Anyway, congratulations again. Love the show. I'm only a recent convert to your show, and I wish I had been around longer listening, as it would have passed last winter much easier. But I'm looking forward to another 50 episodes and many more. Take care. Ciao.
Thanks for that, Ben. I appreciate the support that you and Alex have given Paleo Cinema, even when I do voicemails to your podcast and get the details wrong. Moving along. Next film I'm going to talk about is a Hong Kong film from 1989, starring Chow Yun-fat. It's called God of Gamblers, and it's a lot of fun. I saw this in the cinema again, so let me think. Yeah, all three films I've seen this time I first saw in the cinema. There was a time in the late 80s and early 90s where I did go to Asian cinema a bit. There were a couple of them around. Was it in Melbourne at the time? Might have been Sydney, might have been Melbourne. I don't quite recall, but I used to go to Asian cinemas and check out a few different things. I saw some early Jet Li films there and a bunch of other stuff, and some quite seedy splatter cum sex films of the time, the ones that didn't quite get to England because they seemed to have some trouble with video nasties at the time. But anyway, Asian cinemas, it was in Melbourne. Yeah, I think it was in Bourke Street. There was an Asian cinema in Bourke Street. It may still be there. It may not. I'm not sure. But the best thing about seeing them, apart from seeing these films that you couldn't see elsewhere and that weren't really too accessible on videotape, is that they had really cool munchies at the concession stands. The mainstream cinemas in Melbourne haven't to this day been able to supply the customer with chili-flavoured beef jerky snacks as a part of the cinema experience. And I think they're losing something there. I really think that that's something that they should look into. It's a bit like places that serve beer in cinemas. It's nice. It's a good part of the experience. And having some really spicy meat-based snackies to go with the films is always good. But I'm digressing a little bit. Okay, so what is The Precy and what the fuck is God of Gamblers? I'll just get my notes going here. It was directed by a guy called Wong Jing, who's another film director. His father was also a film director, and he did mostly exploitation films. He's a bit like a much more prolific Brian Trenchard-Smith of Hong Kong cinema. He made films like Naked Killer and gangster films like Young and Dangerous and a whole bunch of other ones. In fact, he did about 175 films up until 2003. Now, Mr. Jing had, or is it Mr. Wong? I'm not sure. But anyway, he had a bit of a trouble in the mid-90s because he kind of spoke out against triad involvement in Hong Kong film, which is probably not the right thing to do because in 1994, some mysterious assailants knocked all his teeth out in the street when he was walking down the road. And he kind of shut up about triad involvement in Hong Kong cinema just after that for some mysterious reason. So poor guy had an interesting life and obviously either has crowns or dentures at this stage. But I'll just do a précis of the film itself. I thought I'd throw that in there. I'll just do a précis of the film itself and go on to why I like it. Doris Sam, the God of Gamblers, is a legendary gambler helped by his supernatural abilities. He undertakes to help a friend pay a debt by beating his friend's adversary at the card table. Despite being assigned a bodyguard, a guy called Dragon, who is very cool, Dosan, his actual name is Ko Chun, but Dosan means God of Gambler, apparently, in Cantonese. So I should say Ko Chun. I'm just reading this off the IMDb at the moment. Ko Chun has a freak accident which leaves him with partial memory loss and the mental age of a child. The small-time hustler Knife, played by Andy Lau, who is quite famous, he was in Infernal Affairs apart from anything else, and his sidekick and his girlfriend, being responsible for the accident, take care of the damaged Ko Chun. After some time, they discover he has not lost all his powers and they take him on a round of the local gambling halls. After being chased by both Knife's loan shark and the enemies closer to home for Ko Chun, a final showdown at the card tables takes place. This film is very cool because it's a stylish action film, and the best action isn't really the action that takes place in the streets, the punch-ups. The best action is actually the cards and the gambling. There are a couple of really kick-ass gambling scenes in this film, and one of them I've found a YouTube clip of, and I'm going to put it onto the show notes for this one at paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. And basically, this guy cannot lose. He's got a supernatural ability, and he may well be an aspect of the God of Gamblers. He may be an aspect of the Buddhist universe that happens to manifest in being very, very good at gambling. He's got a few character traits which make him interesting. He's got a jade pinky ring. He's incredibly fond of chocolate. And when he is himself, before he has the accident, he has this kind of smiling, calm, cocky confidence, which is very, very appealing. You could easily get a man crush on this guy. At the start, he's one way, and that, this is something I should mention before I go any further. A lot of Asian cinema, I've found, seems to have this ability, which we don't really see in, or it's not encouraged in Western film, of being able to go from slapstick comedy to some incredibly serious drama and some nasty action scenes without too much transition. If the kind of things that happen in this film were to happen, say, in a modern Hollywood film, people would say that it's neither fish nor fowl. It goes from slapstick comedy to, incredibly ugly seriousness. I mean, one of the main characters fairly very close to Ko Chun, the Chow Yun Fat character, is killed during the film. I'm not going to give too much more of a spoiler than that, but there's some incredibly ugly and gritty things, and some things that happen after that death which don't really fit in with the action comedy genre. But maybe that's our limitations as Western viewers as well. You just got to open yourself up sometimes and just go, okay, it's a different film aesthetic in certain countries. And when you're watching a film from those countries, you tend to get more out of it if you just go with the flow and accept that. Some people can do that. I've talked to a couple of people about this film who really had a problem with the seriousness balanced against the comedy aspects. And the comedy, of course, comes from the fact that after he has a bit of a head injury, Ko Chun becomes a childlike amnesiac who's taken in by these minor hustlers, Knife and his friends, and basically looked after by them and Knife's grandmother in some very poor accommodation on the edges of Hong Kong. Chow Yun-fat's great. He does the whole arc from the serious, confident and cocky god of gamblers to the childlike person who they nicknamed Chocolate, because even when he's not himself, he's incredibly fond of chocolate. And I think Chow Yun-fat eats about 300 little squares of chocolate during this film. There's an incredible amount of chocolate consumed, and I'm sure there must be a credit to some kind of chocolate company there. He doesn't like M&M's, because they give him a whole bunch of M&M's at one stage and he rejects them. But he's got a taste for very high-quality chocolate. So, but as I said, the action scenes are the bit in this. There's an action scene with the dice game, which is fantastic. Action scene with cards. There's an action scene with Mahjong tiles as well. And they kind of build up this mystique of this guy being unmatchable in any way as a gambler. And as the story resolves itself at the end during the final card game, it just shows how much he thinks ahead and how much he realizes what's going on more than you would expect him to, given the fact that he's had about three or four great big whacks to the head. Yeah, and I like the film. I like it for a number of reasons. I like the fact that they've taken action into a new arena, and some of the cinematography is very effective. There's one scene in particular where they're sliding cards across the table and the camera tracks the cards in front of the card. And I know that that's a lot simpler to do now with the kind of cranes and technology we have now, but at that stage, I can see it being an incredibly hard scene to set up, but it does give a lot of more weight to some of the action scenes by having that that kind of dynamism in what could essentially look boring if it's filmed wrong. A card game can look boring if you just film it wrong, the way they do in a lot of those celebrity poker tournaments, that they can get a bit dull and the celebrities are there basically to tart up bits of cardboard going across a green felt table. But I like this film. There are some good action scenes as action scenes as well. I shouldn't really minimize them. Dragon, the bodyguard character, who in this film is played by Charles Hung, is fantastic. There's a scene where he's protecting Ko Chun on a train in Hong Kong, and there are some really nice action sequences in there. They're not played over long, but they're played very effectively and well. And the little bits of side stuff where Chow Yun-fat's watching this going on make the film a lot of fun too. And there's also another one with Andy Lau, where he's escaping from the loan sharks and climbs out of a window of a building, and they've got that bamboo scaffolding that a lot of construction work in various Asian countries has in lieu of steel scaffolding. And there are some really nice stunt bits in that, some of which are actually done by Andy Lau. You can see that it's actually him doing some of these incredibly dodgy-looking stunts. I don't know how high they really were off the ground, but just the athleticism of them really puts it across very well. And they almost kind of steer into that kind of Jackie Chan 1980s territory, which is a big plus for action film fans. So that's good too. I like that too, because there are bits of this film which might be a bit slower if it wasn't for these action sequences, and to keep the pace going they actually do have these off the wall and unexpected action sequences, which are very well done in the great manner that Hong Kong action films were in the 1980s, and keep the narrative flowing. They don't actually stop the narrative. They're part of the narrative, but even though they kind of don't progress the plot, they keep the film's energy levels up so that you can enjoy them. There's not too much else to say about this film. I do like it a lot. I don't know how available it is. It did generate a bunch of sequels as well. There's a God of Gamblers 2 with Andy Lau in it, where he's playing pretty much the same character he was in this film. And then there's another God of Gamblers 2, which stars Chow Yun-fat and starts with some incredibly ugly violence and some very nasty stuff. And I think there's a God of Gamblers 3 as well. I may be wrong, but I haven't really done my research on that, and I do apologise. Hong Kong films can generate sequels in every direction. They just spray them out like shotgun pellets. And this film didn't. I haven't seen the Chow Yun-fat God of Gamblers 2 in a very long time. I do have a copy of it on DVD. I just haven't been able to get around to it yet, so I may do that after the podcast and just have that as a chill-out film. But Chow Yun-fat, I don't think he's ever been used particularly well in Hollywood when he came over to Hollywood. I think there may be a language barrier there, in a similar way there is to a certain extent for Jet Li. But his charisma and just the way he carries himself and the style of the man in this, and of course all the movies he did with John Woo. There is gunplay in this film, some of which is done by Chow Yun-fat, and it's always a bit of fun to see him with two pistols in his hand. But not too much else to say. See the film if you can. It's a good, solid late 80s action film. It's got slightly synthesizer-type score on it. I won't play any audio from it because unless you speak Cantonese, it's pretty much not going to mean a hell of a lot to you. And if you do speak Cantonese, I'm sorry I haven't put any in there. But that's about it for that. See it. See any other Hong Kong action films that you can from any time from late 60s onwards. They're always a lot of fun. They're always accessible. If you can't get used to subtitles, get used to subtitles. And just enrich yourself with that. I really have to catch up with more Chinese film, more recent Chinese film, than I have too. I mean, I've seen all the usual things like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and a bunch of other things like that. But I've really got to dive beyond the major action films of modern times in Asian cinema and get back into a bit of that. But, of course, you've only got so many hours in a day and you've got to spend some time earning money. Anyway, I'm going to take another break and another audio from somebody wishing us happy 50th, and then we'll talk about the last film, Die Hard.
Hi, Terry. This is Troy Date from the Pacific Northwest. I want to congratulate you on 50 episodes of Paleo Cinema. I really appreciate your podcast. I can tell you put a lot of hard work and research into it, and the films you choose are always top-notch. So thanks a lot for that. I want to leave you with a trivia question. What movie is the following soundtrack from? That, of course, was the 1973 animated science fiction classic, Fantastic Planet. Thanks again, Terry, and keep on podcasting.
Thanks for that, Troy, and thanks for the audio clip. I thought it was from some obscure Emmanuel movie, but I would have been wrong. Troy, again, is another person who's been a big supporter of the podcast, and I do appreciate that. So, anyway, got to get into the 800-pound gorilla in the room, Die Hard. Here's a question I'm going to pose, and I'm going to answer it a bit later on. What's the connection between this movie and Frank Sinatra? I'm not going to tell you now. I'm going to tell you later. Okay, Die Hard, 1980. Some sources say 1988, some say 1989. I saw it in 89. I've talked before about Die Hard and my history with Die Hard. The fact that I won a $500 bet from a charter airline pilot over who played the head of the Nakatomi Corporation in this film. He got it wrong, I got it right. He embarrassed himself in front of a bunch of people. And I had my God of Gamblers moment waiting for the film to end. Die Hard, we all know the plot. I'm going to go through it anyway, just in case somebody's been living in a cave for 25 years and really hasn't got a heads up on it. New York detective John McClane, Bruce Willis, arrives in Los Angeles to reconcile with his estranged wife, Holly Gennaro, Bonnie Bedelia. McClane is driven to the Nakatomi Plaza building by a limo driver named Argyle. The company Christmas party is disrupted by the arrival of 13 terrorists led by Hans Gruber, Alan Rickman. The terrorists cut the telephone lines, seal the building exits, and replace the building guard with one of their own. Hans and his group secure the partygoers as hostages, but McClane manages to slip into the stairwell of the building. Gruber portrays himself to the police as a terrorist working towards various extremist goals, but he ain't. John McClane basically beats the living shit out of the lot of them. Now, originally this film was going to be somewhat different. It was going to be Commando 2 starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, but for some reason that didn't come together, and so they offered it to a bunch of other people, including Sylvester Stallone. And to be honest, if either of those guys had played the role, I think it would have been a much lesser film and a much more forgettable film, because the guts of this is Bruce Willis. At this stage, he'd made a couple of feature films. He made Blind Date. He made Sunset for Blake Edwards, starring as Tom Mix, the cowboy star, against James Garner playing Wyatt Earp, and he got good reviews on that. Good film too. It's well worth picking up a copy of. But mostly he'd been known for working on Moonlight in the TV series with Sybil Shepherd. In fact, he filmed a lot of this film at nights after working on Moonlighting all day. So if John McClane looks a bit exhausted at times, chances are Bruce Willis was as well. It was directed by John McTiernan, a director whose career hasn't had quite the arc that Bruce Willis has had. He's had his successes and his failures, but he's not in the A-list anymore. At the level of someone like Joe Carnahan or Michael Bay or any of those other guys. But the screenplay by Stephen E. D'Souza, who in fact also wrote another of our favourite films here, and also I know it's one that Sidney Coltani are quite fond of. And if I'm wrong, bad little me. Let me see what I've got there. The Return of Captain Invincible, he wrote that as well, so there's an Australian connection there for the people at Sidney Coltani, and I know you guys actually like making these associations. Now, I'm going to go back to what I spoke of earlier, the association between this film and Frank Sinatra. And it ain't just because you could easily see Bruce Willis say ring-a-ding-ding. This movie is based on a novel, which wasn't originally called Die Hard. It's a novel by a writer called Roderick Thorpe. The original title of the book, it's a 1966, it's actually a sequel to a 1966 novel, but this one's called Nothing Lasts Forever. It was a sequel to Roderick Thorpe's 1966 novel, The Detective, which was made into a film starring Frank Sinatra as a New York cop called Joe Leland. Now, the book, which I haven't read in a long time, but I do have it right in my hand here, Joe Leland, the cop played in the original movie by Frank Sinatra, visits the Claxon Oil Corporation's headquarters in Los Angeles, where his daughter Steffi Leland Gennaro works. While he's visiting a German terrorist team led by Tony Gruber take over the building, Leland remains undetected and fights off the terrorists one by one, aided outside the building by LAPD Sergeant Al Powell. So you can see that the plot line's there. And one of the reasons I think why Die Hard has such a tight and good structure is because the source material is good. It's a novel. It's something concrete there. They can mess around with it, but they can't really break it. And it works really well. If you want to catch The Detective as well, if you see that film, it's one of Sinatra's best later films and quite good in it. I don't think it did particularly well. And there are some bits of it that are a bit ugly from modern points of view. But it is definitely worth seeing. But back to Bruce Willis for a moment. I think that kind of the fact that Bruce Willis isn't your pumped and steroided action hero was a blessed relief to people in 1988. I just found out that it is actually 1988. People had seen Schwarzenegger in Predator and The Terminator and all those other action films of the time, and Stallone Ramboing his guts out in various locations across the world, and they were in the mood for something a bit different. You know, the action's as ramped up as in any of Schwarzenegger or Stallone's films, but the fact that they actually got a decent actor to play the role really does make a big difference. Excuse me while I just take a sip of water, because my throat is going. Bruce Willis is a fine actor when he's allowed to be, or when he chooses to be. I think in films, he did the first episode of the remade Twilight Zone TV series, based on a Harlan Ellison short story called Shadowday, and he is excellent in that. He's been excellent in any other film, and any number of other films as well. I mean, Pulp Fiction, of course, he was brilliant in. But watch him when he's doing any role that doesn't require him to shoot a gun. A film like Unbreakable, even, that Bruce Willis in Unbreakable is pretty understated but spectacular in that film. And, of course, The Sixth Sense, he was fine in that too. So I've always had time for Bruce Willis as an actor, as well as a big Hollywood star. I think that there is a certain intelligence to what he does, which really makes it work. And I think even though this is fairly early in his career, there's a whole bunch of good stuff in Die Hard, and he doesn't hit a false note anywhere in the film. Every moment of his acting is perfect for where the character is. And given the fact that he's on the film, he's on the screen a hell of a lot of the time, when Alan Rickman isn't, it's a star vehicle for somebody who had been in a couple of films but hadn't really been the tentpole for film before. And he really came to the game, and of course this is why he's the star he is today. Then of course one of the things that a lot of action films forget, and a lot of action films subsequent to Die Hard forget, is the villain has to be as interesting, but not more interesting, than the hero. And Alan Rickman's great in this. First feature film he ever did was Die Hard. And he gives this slyly humorous and nuanced acting role, and just runs with it. Now I'm going to play some audio from Die Hard. You've all heard it before, but I'm going to give my throat a rest for a moment, and then get back into why I think this movie pisses miracles and shits wonders.
I thought I told all of you I want radio silence until further...
I'm very sorry, Hans. I didn't get that message.
Maybe you should have put it on the bulletin board. I figured since I
waxed Tony and Marco and his friend here, I figured you and Carl and Franco might be a little lonely, so I wanted to give you a call.
How does he know so much about this?
This is very kind of you. I assume you are our mysterious party crasher. You are most troublesome. For a security guard?
Sorry, Hans, wrong guess.
Would you like to go for double jeopardy where the scores can really change?
Who are you, then?
Just a fly in the ointment, Hans. The monkey in the wrench. A pain in the ass.
Check on all the others. Don't use the radio. See if he's lying about Marco and find out if anyone else is missing. Mr. Mystery Guest. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Unless you want to open a front door for me.
No, I'm afraid not. But you have me at a loss. You know my name, but who are you? Just another American who saw too many movies as a child. Another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne, Rambo, Marshall Dillon.
I was always kind of partial to Roy Rogers, actually. I really like those sequin shirts.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Gotta love that dialogue. It's sharp, it defines the characters, and it gives you the mindset that John McClane gets into to survive this ordeal. He's got to become a cowboy. He's got to be on his own resources. He's got to be fast with a gun. And he's got to forget for the duration that he's a cop. He's acting as a soldier more than a policeman. He passes on the role of policeman, of course, to Al Powell, who's outside and assisting him on the walkie-talkie, played by Reginald L. Johnson. This film's it's been used a lot as a template for other movies. There are any number of other films that have been like this. I mean, Under Siege with Steven Seagal was Die Hard on a boat. You know, there's been Die Hard on spaceships. There's been Die Hard on aeroplanes. There's been Die Hard everywhere except, I think, a Thai brothel. But yeah, it's one of those kind of blueprint movies that a lot of other films are based on. And the script is used by a lot of people who teach screenwriting to show you how to resolve plot points at the end of a film. There's about a 2-minute sequence right at the end of this movie which resolves at least half a dozen to 15, anywhere between half a dozen and 15 different plot points are resolved mostly non-verbally within a very short period of time at the end of the film. And that's good screenwriting. there are only a few people that can do that sort of thing. I can think of people like Shane Black could probably do it, and William Goldman, and a few other screenwriters. But, what else can you say about Die Hard? I'm going to play some more audio in a moment just because I enjoyed so much. But I really think that this film took the action genre into a different direction a lot. I think that they realised that you just don't need somebody who can read a terse one-liner and flex muscles and move as necessary. That having a kind of everyman character in this sort of a situation is really a way of ramping up the tension of it. I mean, there are scenes in this film, particularly things like walking across a broken glass and doing a bunch of other physically painful things, where the way it's filmed really does emphasize the fact that this guy's hurting while he's doing those things, that there is a physical cost to the actions that he's performing and the things he has to do to survive, which aren't always or ever really apparent in a number of other action films with a number of other action stars, all the way from Schwarzenegger at one end to, say, Stone Cold Steve Austin at the other. They rarely look like they're really hurt, whereas Bruce Willis in all of the Die Hard films, less so perhaps in the last one, but in most of the Die Hard films, really has put a lock on that illusion of really physically suffering, and that goes back to the source material. In the book, Joe Leland is not a young man. His daughter works in a corporation, so he's a middle-aged to late middle-aged man, and suffers physically for the actions he undertakes in the novel version of this film, which I do recommend. I mean, always go back to the source material. If you enjoy a film, find the book it's based on, find the poem it's based on, find whatever source material there is. And I've never seen the experience of the film diminished by that. You can see where bits of the film come from. You can see the reasons for things that maybe haven't quite been explained to your satisfaction in the film if you go back to the source material. And in Die Hard, particularly, even though as a standalone film it's fantastic, in Die Hard the source material is strong, and the film itself has been built on that strength rather than just chucking out the baby with the bathwater and keeping the cool stuff that you can plug to a studio head when you're pitching the movie. They really have gone with quality there, and in a weird sense, it's an incredibly well-thought-out action film, and rightly it stands pretty much by itself as the defining action film with that kind of cusp between the 1980s and the 1990s. And, of course, popularity, one of the measures of popularity, apart from the fact that it made a shitload of money, is how many imitators you are. There are films that do that. I mean, there's this one, Die Hard. Pulp Fiction spawned a whole bunch of films based on it as well. Alien and Aliens spawned a whole bunch of imitators. It's like the bastard children of these films are everywhere you look on the shelves. Even to this day, there are films that are going, okay, well, they pinched that from Die Hard, or they're trying to do this from Die Hard. And that, in a sense, is the mark of a quality film. People want some of the magic to rub off on what they do, so they copy it, which is another reason, of course, we go back to the problem with remakes of films. People want some of the magic and aren't willing to earn it. They steal it from Aladdin's cave. But that's not too much else. I'm going to play another bit from Die Hard, and I'm going to read a couple of emails that we got and tie this puppy up, and then get into the second half of the first 100 Paleo Cinema podcast next time around.
After all your posturing, all your little speeches, you're nothing but a common thief.
I am an exceptional thief, Mrs. McLean, and since I'm moving up to kidnapping, you should be more polite.
Yeah, Alan Rickman's got to be the best James Bond villain never to appear in a James Bond film. I think him up against Daniel Craig will be rather interesting. Anyway, on to the emails. Okay, our old buddy Rickster, a.k.a. Serps, has sent an email. He says, first, great news on the new job. Congrats to that all, and all that, most sincerely. As for your request on sending MP3 voicemails to you, I wish I could, but I haven't the first idea how to go about it. As you probably already know, my audio blog has gone tits up because I'm not technologically savvy enough to know where to find another audio host site. Be that as it may, I certainly want to prematurely wish you a great big 5-0 podcast and wishing you many more. You won't survive to make too many more, however, if you keep getting your wedding tackle out on chilly Scottish locks. I must say that I applaud any and all opportunities to elicit free DVDs from anyone, so it was well worth it. Love the Sam Fuller podcast. I'm a big fan of all three films you discussed, and sadly I can't think of anything to add to your impressions. What a boring fan letter. Ah, well, one cannot provide sparkling bon mots all the time, can one? Maybe I'll do better next time. Until then, look forward to the big 5-0. All my best, Rickster, a.k.a. Serps. Thank you very much. You've been a big supporter of the podcast right from the word go, and I really do appreciate that, Rickster. What else can one say about Sam Fuller? I may well look at more Fuller films in the future, but I don't want to turn it into a Sam Fuller podcast, which it could very easily be, because there's a lot to say about each of his films. I did see one of his early films recently too. I haven't mentioned that. Park Row, which is about the setting up of a newspaper in 19th century New York. Small film that Fuller financed himself. But it's worth tracking down if you can, because it's very low budget but quite interesting. Let's see what else he said. Technologically savvy, it doesn't take a lot. What I suggest is, if you are interested in getting into doing audio of any kind, podcasts or anything else, definitely ask me questions. I'm here to answer them if you have any trouble with things, or else, of course, the usual thing, just Google it. But thank you again for your support throughout the first 50 podcasts. Let's see who else we've got on here. Got a Facebook thing from Michael Allman, and let's have a look there. Your podcast is among the most educational and insightful on the net. Always entertaining. Thanks. He's just friended me up on Facebook, and he's just got into the podcast. So thank you very much for that, Mike. Stuff like that always keeps me going on doing podcasts. There are times when you think, what the fuck am I doing? You know, this is taking a lot of research and a lot of time. These thoughts usually come up at about 3 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep, and or maybe I've drunk too much coffee the day before. But yeah, I mean, the fact that we have an audience for podcasts, and that everyone's sharing the love of films and sharing suggestions for films, is what keeps us all going. So that is about it for the podcast. This one has gone slightly over time compared to the other ones, but it's the 50th, so what the fuck. Not sure what I'm doing next time around. I want to try to get into some more science fiction, but I've got to find ones that are accessible but obscure. I don't want to kind of rehash over films that everybody knows inside out, and I can't really add any value to, but I am going to look into that. I've got a slightly wider purview now that I've given it an extra 10 years on paleo cinema, so I'm quite comfortable with that decision. Anyway, I'm going to tie it up here. Thank you for everybody for your support. Thanks to all the other podcasts I listen to. Cinecultania, of course. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. You guys are a class act as well. B-Movie Cast. Always enjoy that stuff. You guys do things in a way and that I really can't do. I keep thinking I've got to do some B-movies. But then every time I kind of look at them, I see that Vince and Nick and everybody else who does that podcast off and on has already covered it sufficiently. Also, there's Show, which is always a lot of fun to listen to. Mail Order Zombie. Have got also into Action Attraction, which is the Metal Mikey podcast. Give that one a go as well. Takes a totally different view on things than I do, and that's fine. I mean, it's a broad church here. We really aren't trying to limit anybody. It's all about expressing how you feel about stuff and great stuff. And if you have any other podcast recommendations, always happy to hear it. Chinstrucker versus Punter, I've been getting into that a bit more, and I'm kind of a bit more comfortable with it than I was. But again, I really like the podcasts that are looking at films that I wouldn't look at, because then I don't have to say, oh, geez, they've done such a good job on that film. I really don't want to touch that movie anymore. Having said that, everybody keep podcasting, keep listening to podcasts, keep encouraging people who do these things for the passion of doing it. And in about 21 days, I'll be back behind this microphone waffling on some more. So take care of yourselves, be safe, have fun, enjoy your movies.